Crosswires, navigating news with faith with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Crosswires, today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens, from a layman's questions and a clergyman's reaction. Now, here's Chris and Father Daniel.
Hello, Father Daniel. How you doing?
Hey, Chris. It's great to be back with you. Are you still on vacation?
I am still deep in the Adirondacks. Do you know what the word Adirondack means?
I don't, actually.
I think it's Algonquin Indian, but it means bark eater.
Okay.
So, yeah, you have a new insult in your back pocket that if you want to call somebody an Adirondack without them knowing what you're calling them.
I'm calling them a bark eater. Yeah. Well, that's good to know. Thanks for the tidbit. Well, during these weeks, I've been traveling to South Carolina, then the D.C. area for my annual retreat, then Indiana for the 20th anniversary of Camp River Ridge, and I'll be heading back to Atlanta soon.
Sounds good. Let's dive in. 30 years ago, I can't believe it's 30 years ago, the film Dead Man Walking had its debut in the movies. Susan Sarandon won an Academy Award for her portrayal of Sister Helen Prejean, and Sean Penn played the death row inmate. She brought to light the Catholic Church teaching that opposed the death penalty in all cases, and she once told an interviewer that we're supposed to love our enemy, not execute the hell out of our enemy. So that belief was featured prominently in the movie and offered this counterpoint to the kind of at the time tough on crime rhetoric of the 90s. Back then, 80% of the American public supported capital punishment. Today, only 50% support capital punishment. I didn't know this, but for most of its history, the Catholic Church did not oppose the death penalty. So during the Middle Ages, the Church endorsed the execution of heretics and held that secular authorities could and should put people to death for serious crimes. And in the early 20th century, the Vatican City's penal code permitted the death penalty for anyone who attempted to kill a pope. The Vatican State abolished this in 1969 they abolished the death penalty for all crimes, and around the same time, the Catholic teachings, the doctrine on the death penalty also evolved to oppose the death penalty in all cases. But if you go back to major theological figures like St. Augustine and St. Thomas Aquinas, they viewed it as a just, that potentially that these things could be viewed as justified killings based on natural law arguments. So can you talk a little bit about this transformation in the church's teaching on the death penalty?
Totally. I think when you understand the underlying rationale behind the church's teaching, a lot of it comes into focus and makes a lot of sense. So historically, when the prison system was maybe not the best, easy for people to escape, there were situations in where society needed to defend itself against someone who was a hardened, inveterate criminal who was a danger to society. I mean, you didn't want to put someone out into society like a Jeffrey Comer who was going to, you know, go out and kill people again. You don't let loose people like that in society. And because they didn't have a prison system like we do today, there was no way for a society to defend itself against those people except by, you know, taking their life. And so that's the position of the church was, yes, the society has to defend itself by taking the life of this person. And you know, oftentimes there were a chaplain who would go and pray for that person, give them everything they could receive before they were killed so that they could convert and go to heaven. There's even a famous story of Saint Therese of Lisieux, as she writes in her autobiography, which is really beautiful, where there was a hardened criminal, a murderer, who was going to be hung, I think it was, and they were taking him through the city in a cart. And she just begged in prayer, asked God to give her the consolation of knowing that he converted before he was killed. It's a beautiful story where she prayed intensely for him and received that confirmation from the Lord that he did. He kissed a crucifix and converted right before he died so that he could receive God's mercy. And the church takes the long-term perspective that this life is not everything. Eternal life is much more important. And so we have to do everything possible to help people to come to eternal life.
Another interesting part of this is that, you know, the church, possibly without knowing it, probably the church knows it, but maybe some of the members of the church don't know it, how much of an influence it really does have on society, the fact that the public's support for the death penalty has dropped from 80% to 50%, and that's got to be largely due to the Catholic Church's teachings, I think, is something that we should not forget.
I think without a doubt. Right.
Right.
Yeah, the church is recognized as a moral authority. And there was a development and growth of our understanding as Catholics on this as the circumstances have changed. The underlying principles have not changed. The church has always talked about the dignity of the human person, the right for a society to defend itself. It's just that the circumstances have changed now in society where we do have a penal system, we have a prison system where we can put people who are a danger to society behind bars and so that they're no longer a danger to society and give them the time that hopefully they can convert and go through the corrections system so that they correct their life. Unfortunately, oftentimes that's not happening. And you know that firsthand, Chris, because you visit prisons and your prison ministry on a regular basis. Every week you're going to a maximum security prison. I don't know if you want to share a little bit of your perspective on that from your experience.
Well, I'd like to actually just point, I think what you said a little bit ago is so important, worth re-saying, that the church views, you know, is taking the long view and the next life is the important one. And so, you know, while the church rightly opposes the death penalty in all circumstances now, the next life, you know, is the one that the church is particularly focused on. Whether their views on the death penalty changed or not, it's always been focused on the next life.
Right. And if people want to reference this, that in number 2267 of the Catechism of the Catholic Church gives the Catholic understanding on the death penalty. And it talks about this historical transformation, which is due not to a change in the underlying principles, but a change in the circumstances in our modern day. And hopefully that helps people to understand that this isn't the church, you know, bowing to the gods of the age and changing its doctrine. No, it's changing the application of the principles of the church because the circumstances have shifted in modern society, which opens up the question, Chris, like, okay, let's say we go to an undeveloped country, somewhere in sub-Saharan Africa where they don't have a solid prison system. Can the government continue to exercise the death penalty because there's no way of taking person out of being a danger to the life of other people?
That's akin to being on the battlefield. If you have a dangerous opposing figure on the battlefield and there is no choice, there's no other way to detain this person over the long haul so that they don't, reemerge to oppose you, battlefield justice makes perfect sense. And that's another form of what you're talking about, because it's really the only, practical way to deal with the situation.
Right. Yeah. And this, it's these moral questions that can be challenging because the church is the first to uphold the dignity and inviolability of the human person, as it says in this number from the catechism. But there are situations when it is justified to kill. Because the commandment is thou shalt not murder. It's not thou shalt not kill, if you look at the original Hebrew words behind it. And so there is a nuance here, and there's historical shift over time that helps us to understand why the church has taken this position against the death penalty in today's day and age.
Crossed Wires. If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Crossed Wires. Houthis, militant group in the Red Sea for the first time since Trump announced a truce, have begun attacking ships again. So two ships, one named the Magic Seas and the other called the Eternity Sea, were hit by gunfire recently from small arms and self-propelled grenades. near a Houthi-controlled port on the Red Sea. So one of the ships has a private security force on board, and the ship did battle for 8 hours until they ran out of ammo. The ship was then boarded and strung with explosives and sunk. There was no U.S. Navy or Allied warship around to help, neither was there any British or European Navy ships close enough to aid. The Catholic rules for self-defense are that the use of force has to be proportionate to the threat, there has to be no other reasonable means, the intention must be to stop the attack, not to kill, and the response has to be immediate and necessary. So you contrast that with the international law outside the 12-mile nautical territory limit, which is, you know, you're now the law of the seas, and ships mm-hmm. have the right to defend themselves against piracy. But it's a legal rather than a moral framework. So the flag state of the ship typically governs the actions of the vessel.
Sure.
So your vocation as a priest, Father Daniel, doesn't require you to be a passive victim of violence, but priests are also called to be, you know, examples of Christ-like behavior. So I want to ask you, if you're on one of these civilian ships and it's under attack and there's both the water cannons, which I think the ships all have as a means of defense, and then they have these private security forces that come on board to act, you know, as their protection. I don't think that they arm these civilian ships with the crew, because then they become more like a military, considered like a military vessel. I'm wondering, in these circumstances, you as a priest, you're on one of these vessels. What are you going to do in this situation where you're under attack?
Oh, gosh. Chris, you're putting me on the spot here. I love this. You know, it's so funny. I actually had a dream last night about a similar type of situation where I was with a group of people and I was being hunted by this Muslim group that was trying to enslave us all. It's a weird dream. But anyway, what I would do, well, my personality is actually pretty conflictive. And I like, if I had a dog that comes up to me and starts barking at me, I would fight back against the dog, and I would probably kill the dog before the dog ever did any serious damage to me. That's just kind of my personality. So in a situation like that, I obviously as a priest, I don't want to kill anyone, but I would fight back in a way to destroy their ship or sink it, not and avoid trying to kill anyone. But if they're sink. Their ship sinks, they're, you know, I didn't kill them. They drowned. That's at least my knee jerk reaction to your question.
Yeah. Well, I do prison ministry, and in the training for prison ministry, you're taught that if there's a fight between prisoners that somehow involves you, if you're attacked, that you're supposed to just lie down. And there's no way I'm just going to, if I'm being stabbed, there's no way I'm just going to lie down. Like in my mind's eye, you know, I'd like to envision that I'm somehow using the crane technique from Karate Kid and knocking the, you know, knife out of your hand.
Right.
But I'm either going to run or I'm going to fight back. I'm not going to lie down, you know?
Right.
So I'm thinking about these ships where basically there's no, why it piqued my interest is when you're in the territories of, you know, when you're on land in a state's territory or within the 12-mile nautical limit, my assumption, let's say you're under attack and you're inside the 12-mile nautical limit, is that your Navy or your Coast Guard is going to come to your rescue, and you really don't have to do anything. You just got to kind of, you know, bide your time.
You would certainly
when you're
hope
out
so.
There,
right.
Yeah, and when you're out there in the open ocean, and it's just the law of the sea, you're really on your own. And so it's why I asked you the question, because it's a totally different dynamic than being under the protection, you know, the jurisdiction of some kind of a police or a, you know, military guard. So, yeah, that's why I wanted your thoughts.
Yeah, and it's interesting. You open up a whole other series of questions, like why are these pirates just going out there and sinking the ships? Are they taking something from the ships? Are they mad because the ships are going through? Are they somehow extorting the different shipping lines that they don't, if they don't pay a certain
there's a whole nother line, as you just kind of alluded to, another line of questions here. This instance is any ship that has visited Israel in the past, whenever, they're going to sink. So they're basically saying
so
that
sort of
part
a reprisal
of supply chain for, you know, either, you know, food, or I don't think it's for military purposes, but that's why they're sinking the ship, because it visited, I think this one ship visited an Israeli port 8 months ago, and so they targeted it for sinking.
Wow, that's crazy.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Israel and Hamas are now hammering out a deal that would see the release of 10 living hostages and the bodies of 18 others in exchange for a 60-day ceasefire and the release of Palestinian prisoners held in Israel. Only 20 of the hostages Hamas is still holding in Gaza are believed to be alive, so half of them, right, would be part of this negotiation of being released. So obviously a poor medical condition would be a priority, and of course if there were women or children, they would be the ones that should go first. But let's say these are 20 able-bodied men, and they are all men, and presumably they are all able-bodied. Assuming they're all, as I just said, able-bodied men, if you're in charge, Father Daniel, how do you choose who gets released?
Only Israeli 10 of the 20 get released. From Hamas?
They're being released from Hamas, so only 10 of the 20. So how do you choose who gets to be released?
That's a tough question. Immediately comes to mind St. Maximilian Kolbe, when the Nazi guard had, you know, they had chosen 10 men to be executed, and he volunteered himself to take the place of a man who had a wife and children. And we know that that heroic act of love on his part is what led to his eventual canonization. So I don't think that you can easily make that decision. I'd never want to be in that position where you have to choose, you know, who gets to go. But I think that among the 20 men themselves, they could say, all right, let's decide among ourselves, and whatever form they come up with for deciding that, I would go with that.
Well, I think that's a great idea, because I was thinking, okay, if I were in charge, that I would just make it a lottery and, you know, the luck of the draw. But I think that's a great way to do it, to first approach it from what you just suggested. And if that doesn't work, then the rest of it, you know, let's say they can only decide that five everybody agrees on, and there's five more are just going to be the subject of a luck of the draw.
Right.
Crossed Wires.
If there's an aspect of this topic that wasn't addressed or you'd like further clarification, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com. Crossed
Wires. Recently, the IRS has come out and said that traditional religious communications are now exempt from a decades-old provision in the tax code, the U.S. tax code, that bars nonprofits, religious or secular, from endorsing political candidates. The Catholic Church has a clear and consistent teaching on political candidate endorsement, and that is to do not do it. So in its role as the teacher, the church can give guidance and direct teaching in areas of legislation, and the church obviously seeks to help Catholics form their conscience so they might, you know, be able to discern which candidates and policies would advance the common good. But this change to the tax law treatment is a big one, and I know that...
Oh, it's huge.
I think I know that many parish priests have been told not to, you know, talk politics on the pulpit for, you know, at least one of the reasons they've been told not to do so is this, you know, tax-exempt status. So do you think this change in the tax treatment is going to result in a change in, one, either the church's stance, or, two, the propensity of, you know, priests and pastors to talk politics on the pulpit?
I think it definitely will change things, Chris. Sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. And I think this requires a bit of maturity on the part of the church. And I would put this in a historical perspective as well. You go back to the early years in the United States history, and, you know, back in Dagger John, who was the Archbishop of New York in the mid-1800s, right around the time of the Civil War, and he endorsed candidates. You know, if he found a candidate who was strongly Catholic or pro-Catholic in a time of a lot of anti-Catholicism in our country, he endorsed them publicly. He even did some political campaigning for some candidates. So the absolute prohibition against endorsement of a candidate is not something that's rooted in Catholic doctrine per se. It is actually more of something that the church has seen as a potential liability because of the IRS regulations over the last 70 years. So with this new interpretation from the IRS, it really does open up a lot more freedom for the church to come out and say explicitly, you know, this candidate is contrary to Catholic teaching, or this candidate is the most aligned with Catholic teaching. We're never going to find perfect political candidates. There's no politician who's got a perfect life personally, or do they sustain every aspect of Catholic teaching to the perfect degree. So there's no such thing as perfection in the realm of politics. But I think it's a fascinating area for the church to exercise more of what Pope Benedict talked about in his encyclical Deus Caritas Est, of, you know, shaping public opinion through the formation of consciences. And I've really been very pleasantly encouraged by the statements from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops in the last two election cycles, when they put out the document, Forming Consciences for Political Engagement. And it's been a very well nuanced document giving guidance to Catholics on how to vote without endorsing candidates. So I think we're going to definitely see a shift in the way things are done, some good, some bad. And hopefully we can stick to the principles of enlightening consciences with the light of the truth.
Well, we have to keep in mind that, you know, we're looking at things from the view of the United States being a democracy, and, mm-hmm. you know, there's very few true democracies around the planet. So,
and we're actually not a democracy. We're representatives of the public, but
right. But you know what I'm saying? Like what most people think of, that they're one person, one vote, and that's not the case in many other political settings around the planet. So the church, the Vatican stance, you know, has to be cognizant of the fact that they're talking about, you know, you might be in a situation where endorsing a particular candidate in one country might put the priest of that parish at risk for some
without
political persecution.
Doubt.
Right?
Yes, and that's happening all the time. There's so many martyrs of this past century, even in the last decade, who have died because they've spoken out against politicians, corrupt politicians. Mexico is the most dangerous place for a Catholic priest in the world right now. And the number of Catholic priests who've been killed by the drug cartels and by shady politicians is just, it's off the charts. And then a lot of other developing countries around the world, the Catholic Church stands up for the truth. It stands up for the underdog, and for sometimes the underdog political candidates who are trying to establish a better political regime. And oftentimes priests and religious and bishops have been martyred in those situations.
Well, I think it's probably best that that churches, that priests and pastors in particular, do not endorse particular political candidates. I think they should stick to talking about specific legislation and the policy that legislators enact, rather than trying to endorse particular candidates. And I think, you know, you can discern and back into who you should vote for based on that, because there's going to be other things that are really not moral matters that are reasons why people vote for, you know, certain candidates that the church should not be, you know, opening Pandora's box on. I think you're just going to turn off half of your congregation. You know,
there's definitely a danger of that. Yeah, right. I think that's very true. And people tend to already have their established ideas about which political party they're going to support. But the church can't abdicate from its role to educate consciences. And
absolutely.
In some cases, there might be a candidate
never
who's
be
completely
fearful.
Opposed to Catholic.
Yeah, never be fearful about speaking the truth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, so I think it's best to just address particular topics rather than people.
Yeah, that's where I'm not sure I agree with you, Chris. And it's okay to disagree, right? And it's kind of fun to do that on air sometimes. I think that the church definitely has to talk about policy and about legislative issues. But the church also has a role to educate consciences when it comes to understanding that a particular politician's stance on an issue is in contrast with Catholic teaching or with what we would consider good as society. Now, the way you go about that, I think, is really crucial. And I think this is where we can get into trouble, Chris, and really stoke certain antagonism towards the church. Because when you don't give the rationale behind why you're saying that a certain candidate is not a good candidate, let's say that someone is an ardent, Green Party, and they think that the candidate, he's the best person because he is going to address climate change and he's really going to help fix these problems in our society. Okay, a person comes in with their certain political views into the pew, and then they hear a father talk and say, X candidate who is the green candidate is no Catholic can vote for him. Well, that's going to stir up antagonism, and I think that's a wrong approach. So I think the approach has to be, these are Catholic principles. This is what we stand for. And you can make the deduction that this candidate aligns with these Catholic principles, which should be guiding our conscience, and this candidate doesn't align with it.
The risk you run here is you have potentially a candidate who is perfectly in line with the church's moral teachings on all of their policy objectives, but the individual themselves is a morally reprehensible person. So I can see where there's going to be folks who are not going to vote for people because of that, even though maybe policy-wise they should. So I think the church is opening up Pandora's box by trying to endorse a person.
There's certainly always going to be a danger there. And that's where we can outline some basic principles, but I think we also have to have the flexibility to recognize there's different circumstances that are going to come up throughout time in different places around the world. So the church has to leave a certain latitude and prudential decision-making on the local level to the bishops, to the priests, and to the church at the local level. And, you know, you bring up a great, great point, Chris. Sometimes there's a misalignment. You know, a politician's personal life is just not exemplary. But their policies is what we're electing them for primarily. Hopefully we can find someone whose personal life and their policies align with Catholic teaching. But sometimes you don't, and you never have a perfect candidate.
Well, it's why we shouldn't put our faith in politics. Our faith is
That's right.
The teachings of the church.
That's exactly right. Our faith is in Christ. He is the Alpha and the Omega, the beginning and the end. And when we place our trust in the Lord, we will not be disappointed.
If there's a topic you'd like Father Daniel to address, send it to crossedwires@thequestatlanta.com.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back again next week with a different take on the news.
This has been Crossed Wires, navigating news with faith, with Father Daniel Brandenburg, LC, and Chris McDonald. Today's secular news stories viewed through a Catholic lens on AM 1160, The Quest.